Well, John Gall, welcome to Studio 22.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
How do you like the chairs?
Yeah, so we're sitting in these huge mitts right now, like legitimate mitts. In fact, I mean, if you look at them, they're almost 19, probably 20 style mitts that you'd toss behind your position, and we're sitting in them, life size. I like them.
It's nice quality leather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, these are really nice.
Footstool to go with it that's shaped like a baseball?
Yeah, they're probably the price of my car.
They really weren't that expensive. I got one of those flyers from the MLBPA where, I don't know, it was kind of like a routine, hey, you know, this is what we're doing sort of thing. And it was a random flyer where it's like, hey, if you go to this website and you punch in this code, MLBPA, you could get 20% off of these big mitt chairs. And without even looking at the deal, like I saw the chair was on this flyer and I'm like, I got to have this. Like there's immediately, and I'm not an impulse buyer at all. I feel like in my life, and you could probably confirm or deny what I'm about to say here, but I don't feel like I'm a big toys guy. Obviously, with the triathlon stuff and the bikes and everything, yeah, sure, okay, fine. But even when it comes to cars or anything, I have never been one of those people to be over the top when it comes to sort of gear or whatever else. So
I can confirm that. I mean, now Eric and I have known each other. We've known each other, what, since we were 4 years old, 5 years old. I was in your bedroom probably playing with whatever we were doing, which was most likely a ball. It wasn't toys. I don't think either of us were big toys guys. But, yeah, these are toys. So these chairs we're sitting in, they're shockingly uncomfortable, actually, when you sit down in them.
You think so?
They look fantastic. Like, these things are like your dream, like in the catalog that my wife has, that she's like, oh, look, this would be amazing for your man den and everything. I'd look at them and be like, oh, let's get them. I can't believe you're on board. And then they'd show up, and then I'd be sitting here right now, and I already need to go see a chiropractor.
Well, I'm totally comfortable. I disagree with you. Now, you know what I did? And obviously, there's two chairs because I'm sitting in one, you're sitting in the other. I called the guy, and I try to order online like we all do. It's amazing what we'll do to avoid a phone conversation in this day and age, right? I want to do everything online. I don't want to talk to a real person. If I'm calling somewhere, I want it automated. I want it quick. That's one of the problems with our society these days. And it's actually, I could go back and even relate it to sort of an inspiration for a podcast. And I think one of the reasons why I've been drawn to a podcast, because I think in a lot of ways, I miss that human interaction that I think is really the very fabric of who we are as human beings.
Well, that's why I think you just radio and podcasts in general still has a place and isn't going anywhere, is because it is. There's a conversation factor. And for whatever reason, the medium of conversation just doesn't come across the same way on TV. And when you watch that, and I do, I'll get on the exercise bike in the morning and you turn on, you know, Colin Cowherd. He's out there and he's sitting there and it just doesn't have the same feel as when I'm in the car listening to him. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I feel like I'm part of that conversation, and that's kind of what podcasts, I think, provide.
So I called this guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we start talking. And it was a former Major League Baseball player. And it was like boneship.com is where you can find him. And immediately you got to assume at some point in his life he had bone chips. So anyhow, we were talking, and he was saying that he had two in the San Francisco Bay Area that were just sitting there in a warehouse. And I told him, I want one for sure, and I'm thinking about if I like the first one, I might get another one. And then, you know, then he was telling me he had two, and I said, well, I mean, they're right there, and it's, you know, easy to deliver, and dad, just give me them both. So I got them. I showed up. My wife was here when they delivered them. I showed up, and when I got home, I was actually in New York at the time. And you know what I did to break him in?
Oh God, don't, what, would you sit here and throw baseballs at him?
No, I tossed my kids in them.
I mean,
I'm not kidding. Go to my Instagram feed right now. If you're listening at any sort of place where you can just kind of fire it up, and you will see a video of me tossing my kids into the chairs to loosen them up a little bit. And I'm with you. I was with you at the beginning. Like, how comfortable are these is sort of the question mark. But then I'm like, you know what? If I want to soften the leather a little bit, so I used the kids as balls.
Well, you know, it was a good idea, but it didn't work. Just to let you know, these things are still off. Like, imagine, like, you're sitting, your back is in between the fingers, these giant fingers, these leather fingers, and you can't get, you really, I mean, there's no way to get comfortable unless you sit straight up in a perfect posture. But then the mitt and the is too big. Essentially, the pocket is too big. So when I'm sitting straight up, it's like my legs can't get off to the end. It's not designed for sitting, but it looks great.
Okay, I just took a picture of you, and you look awfully comfortable. And I will go ahead and post this picture when I post the Gallstar interview. So here's the deal with John Gall, for those who do not know. John and I, he mentioned that we grew up together. As a matter of fact, we're actually cousins by marriage. My aunt, Sally, my mother's sister, is married to his father's brother, Uncle Jeff. And the first time, and my mom and your mom love telling the story, that you and I actually met was when I was 4 and you were 2. And I had orchestrated some sort of baseball game that we were playing. And you came along and you wanted to play. And I said, get this kid out of here. He can't play. He's too small. And sure enough, I don't know, somebody else, I think it was Tristan Perwath maybe, said, no, he's going to play. And, of course, being the all-inclusive great kid that Tristan was, and sure enough, throws you a ball and you freaking whack it, just about take my head off. And I turn around and say, oh, okay, you can play.
And so Eric and I are 2 years younger than each other and ended up playing on the same little league team and high school and played against each other at college. I was at Stanford. Eric went to UCLA. And then both went on to play professional baseball. And I had a few years of up and down in the major leagues with St. Louis and Miami. And Eric had a little longer career. But where we came from, I think, is important, because Northern California, we take it for, you know, sort of for granted because we've lived here our whole life. But baseball wasn't really the fabric of Portola Valley, which was a small little country town without any stoplights, one gas station, you know, as many horses as people probably, or somewhat close to that, and way more Grateful Dead tie-dyed shirts at school than probably anything else. But Eric and I were drawn to baseball. I mean, it was a great environment to grow up back then.
But it's crazy because, you know, like you mentioned, you know, here, first of all, Portola Valley is right in the heart of Silicon Valley. It borders on Palo Alto. So we grew up, I'd say, in almost a cross between Silicon Valley pioneers in some, I don't want to say older, that's your old money is the right word for it. That's more Atherton. But Silicon Valley pioneers, and then this sort of hippie generation that had lived in Portola Valley and Woodside and sort of the outskirts of the San Francisco Bay Area. I believe it was Jerry Garcia had a place up on Skyline at one time. I know Neil Young had a place up there. Tracy Chat. It's just sort of this. It's very eclectic when it comes to the characters of this area. And to think that two guys, and you mentioned your background. Look, John went to, not only did he go to Stanford, but he became the all-time Pac-12 hits leader. And he still holds that record today. And then he ended up in the big leagues with the St. Louis Cardinals the year they won a World Series. So he has a World Series ring. Not to mention the fact in 2008, went to the Olympics with Team USA and played on Team USA. Tell me about that for a second, because it's interesting. There's a lot of guys who are stars right now in Major League Baseball who were on that 2008 Olympic team.
Well, the two guys that stick out, and I'll start with Jake Arrieta, who watching him sort of mature as a pitcher has just been really fun, because I was at the end of my baseball career. We had a combination of guys on that 08 team that were sort of the veteran guys, bring some experience, and then some young, just exceptional talent, which included Jake and Strasburg. Those were our two guys. And at the time, nobody knew these, you know, who they were. They were just, you know, coming up. And the Arrieta was still with the Orioles actually at the time. But, you know, you could see all these young talent. And I was curious to see who was going to end up making it, you know, who's going to have the best career. And now we're 8 years later, and you can start to make those sort of projections a little bit more accurately, you know, because I don't know if you can.
If you say Strasburg and Arrieta, I still think that's going to be a toss up at this point.
It could be.
Jake had the better season last year, but he's got to show me that.
Okay,
year
but
in and year out.
Okay, but when on the team, I would have said Trevor Cahill had the best. Boy, I'll tell you what, Cahill and that sinker he was rolling is phenomenal. I mean, when I was facing him, I felt more uncomfortable in the inter-squad games going against Cahill. Brett Anderson. I mean, what he could do, moving the ball in and out. You know, those two guys to me weren't much different at that time than Jake Arrieta. Now, Strasburg is a different animal. Okay. I mean, I remember we were in Raleigh-Durham, just getting to know everybody. All got us together, practice for a week or two, and we go out for an inner squad. We had a few pops the night before, so, you know, not everybody's all there. But here's Strasburg, this kid. He was the only college kid on the team. He was actually from San Diego State, and we heard he threw 100 and all this. And it took 9 pitches to strike out 3 guys on, they were 100-mile-an-hour pitches, but then he had this everything was electric, right? The curveball. I mean, the changeup, I think we were still behind it. It was just insane. It was 90-mile-an-hour changeup, but the thing was dropping off the table. So, you know, we had instant respect for him, but he had stuff that was sort of beyond anyone's stuff. And that goes back to the point where, you know, they draft him, and he really should have been in the big leagues like the minute they drafted him. Like, to even waste a pitch in the minor leagues was a shame.
Outside of injuries, is there a reason why he hasn't had success? Anyway, when I say success, it's just you come up with that stuff that you're talking about. Right? We want to see a sub-3 ERA every single year. We want to see him lead the league in strikeouts. It just hasn't been that way.
I'm going to answer to you simply, in my opinion. It's bad karma in Washington. When Rizzo sat him down during the playoffs, and what's the reason we all play baseball, right? What is the reason? It's to win, right? That's the idea. Every fan out there wants their team to win. And Rizzo made it clear that wasn't his goal, was to win the championship when they sat him down. And to me, that type of karma, and I think that really messed with Strasburg at the time, because he wanted to win. You could tell with some of his reactions. He was a pro. I mean, I give him a lot of credit for how he handled that situation. But they had an opportunity that year to win. I think it was the Giants ended up winning that year, and I hope they got a nice thank you note out to the Nationals for sitting Strasburg, because that was sort of his year. And when you're looking at somebody elevating their career and getting going at that point, and him not getting that postseason experience where he may have been the star, you know, who knows what would have happened injuries wise, you know, yeah, it still might have popped. But to me, I look back at that situation, and I don't know if you guys believe in karma or whatever. I just look back and go, oh, that to me is the defining point of where his career just kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Nothing, and that has nothing to do with him. I think that he's done a great job battling through everything.
So what about position player-wise? Who was the best player on that team?
Oh, position player-wise, I'm trying to think if there's who else would have been on that team that's really kind of blossomed. There was
Dexter Fowler was on the team.
Fowler was on the team, and he was always a big prospect, you know, coming through.
He's had a nice career.
He has had a nice career. You know, the guy that was the biggest prospect probably at that point, at least from what I had heard, was Matt LaPorta, who was with Cleveland. And just didn't click it together. But, you know, it's just amazing. I remember watching him, and you take these great batting practice, stay on plane, shoot, you know, home runs to right, left. He's a right-handed hitter. And most guys probably don't know him unless they're diehard Indian fans.
So this was like the ultimate minor league all-star team. and Steven Strasburg, who was still in college.
Basically, you know, I mean, we had some other guys, you know, Taylor Teagarden, who was a, you know, catcher at the time, Shearholz, Nate Shearholz, who, you know, he's done all right for himself, bouncing around and doing whatever, but he had a nice little time. And you might remember the one thing, because it got no run, the Olympics in 08. Was when Shearholz he buried the Chinese catcher. It was like, I think it was the only thing that got first run in SportsCenter that during the Olympics.
I knew exactly what you're talking about. I mean, that was the signature of the Olympics. A lot of people will even make an argument. I don't want to say a lot of people make this argument, but some people will make the argument that might be one of the reasons why baseball is no longer in the Olympics.
No. It was actually already out of the Olympics at that point. So it was already scheduled not to be in 2012. Now, we think it's coming back in 2020. And as you know, I'm on the board of directors with USA Baseball, and I'm like involved with all of that quite a bit. But
Okay. That was a far stretch.
Yes.
But it was perceived, right, by the rest of the world. Here's the Americans in a sport that really they invented it, and here they are bullying the rest of the world and the Chinese at this point on the Chinese's own turf in Beijing.
Even worse, so the host country gets a team. Well, China doesn't even play baseball.
Yeah,
so they had to get that whole team put together and somehow make it competitive, and they got, I think, blown out of every game or whatever they were allowed to play in. And so I think the score may have been, you know, 8-0 or 7-0 or somewhere in that range. But everyone knew the game was not going to be close. Like, so there's no need to blow up the catcher. You know, now if it was Cuba and we were down 6-0 in the third inning or whatever, you know, you got to get every run you can get, but not necessary. But Nate was my roommate out there. We had a blast.
Yeah, but
we
all loved it, of right? Course. There wasn't one American player and it wasn't anything against the Chinese baseball team. It was just, hey, look, you're out there, and we're trying to win, right? I mean, there's part of me that when I look at that, I'm disappointed when you know that Cuba's sending their best, and I believe, was Japan sending their best?
Oh, they had their best.
They stopped their season.
Oh, are you kidding me? Yeah, I mean, we had we was Darvish and Tanaka.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that was who we had. That was who we faced. I mean, yeah, it was incredible. But I mean, China had, I think it was Jim LaFever was the manager. And so he was pissed. He was so pissed.
I was going to ask you who the manager of China was. I just remember the Chinese manager, who I know was American, was the one that sort of made the big deal out of it. And I mean, rightfully so from his perspective. But at the same time, in the wussified world that we live in a little bit, I don't know. There's something about some good old-fashioned hardball that sits okay with me.
I love it. And it was, you know, this was before the whole Posey thing, and now we got the rule changes and all of the stuff now that it makes the game less entertainment. So going to these international fields, and the big thing is the WBC and the Dominicans and how they, you know, are so emotional on the field, and I'm a big proponent of it. I love it. I love all the emotion on the field. I think baseball needs more entertainment, not less, more showboating. I love it all. But it needs to become part of the culture here, and it's not happening overnight. It's just gradually happening. But that's the same part of it. That's the fun part. When a guy gets blown up at home, even when the guy is turning two, you know, at second and just gets taken out. And there's ways, obviously, that have been taught for years to not get injured while you're getting taken out there. It's part of the game.
What do you have on the rule changes? What do you have on the rule change at home plate? What do you have on the new rule that was just implemented at second base? Pretty much saying that the base runner has to slide for the most part directly into second base without, I don't know the exact verbiage of it, but they've tried to clean it up because of the injuries that took place last year, primarily obviously the one with Chase Utley in the playoffs, but also Gong from Pittsburgh. His season was ended on a play at second base as well.
Well, I actually think the second base rule makes the most sense, more sense than the catcher's rule. In my opinion, we haven't seen it implemented yet. I want to see how the umpires are calling it, whatever. But I mean, there were times where these guys are going 6-7 feet out of the base pass, and really, to me, it should have been called based upon the rules that already existed. Because you're not establishing a baseline out there. You're out of the baseline. That there already was a problem. It just wasn't being properly called. As far as home plate, catcher's got gear on. He's got the ability to get out of the way. Let's not try to pretend like he can't see the runner coming in his peripheral while the ball's coming from right field. It's there. I thought that rule was overdone. I think that you should still be able to run into the catcher and knock that ball out. And it's a great play for the game. It's super entertaining. And catchers have been dealing with it for 100-something years. I'm disappointed in how that rule was implemented.
I still feel that there is not great clarification with the rule. I'm okay with the rule in what they're trying to do. But from the way I understand it, you could still barrel over the catcher so long as the catcher has the ball and is blocking the plate. And the catcher can still block the plate so long as he has the ball. He just can't block the plate without the ball. So, again, it almost goes back to the way they're finally implementing the rules the way they should have been at second base and even at home. Now, the difference is that players now, and you can see, because I believe there was one, maybe two home plate collisions all of last year. That was it. I think it was Steven Souza Jr., who was one of the guys that blew up the catcher at home. I remember that being in Tampa. But overall, and you mentioned you were on the board of USA Baseball, but you're also on another board that has to do with preserving the health of players.
It's a health and safety committee.
You're on the health and safety committee, and you don't like the home plate rule. How does that sit with the rest of your board members?
Well, as far as safety is concerned, yeah, it would not sit well at all. And I mean, you do have a point as far as how that rule is implemented. And in fact, in the past, there was I don't remember any time in my lifetime where the runner had been called out because of targeting or something. I think that was actually in the rule book that they could have done that, but they never did. But no, the Health and Safety Committee is more geared towards research on the youth baseball and professional baseball side, as far as injuries. And you know, this is down in Birmingham, James Andrews and his clinic, which is the clinic, I mean, in America, as far as research on baseball injuries. And the one thing that they've just found over the last 30, 40 years of doing this research since the 80s when they began it, is just almost all injuries when it comes to arm injuries is overuse. It's just overuse. And you get into amazing data that they have, and it's not curveballs, by the way, at all. There's no research out there that proves the curveballs cause any extra problems with the arm. And getting this message out to the parents and the youth baseball and everything is really the challenge these days. And playball.org, which is also where we have some information on playball, which the MLB just started to promote last year during the All-Star break, which is a great resource for parents and kids and everything on everything from baseball, how to play second base to how to tie your shoes. I mean, literally everything. There's a bunch of information that we provided on that website.
My counter to the James Andrews theory is that I've spent 5 winters in the Dominican Republic, and kids there start playing baseball by the time they're, I would say, about 2 years old. By the time they could walk, pick up a stick, pick up a rock, they're playing baseball. It's what they do. It is everything that the country is about. Now, one of the things I noticed when I finally went down there and played is not just that they play baseball year-round, but their arms, the way they long toss, the way they throw on a daily basis. And then, you know, I could take it a step further and talk about the Japanese players. And you hear about the stories of these kids going out there and throwing 200 pitches. If you look in this, I did this probably about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. I looked at the amount of documented Tommy John surgeries at the major league level. And the number was somewhere around 300 at the time. And of the 300, 90% of those were American players. The proportion's not right there, because if you look at the compilement of Major League Baseball players and ethnicity, 40% of the league is non-American. And, you know, it varies every single year, even daily with, you know, guys going up and down. But really, it's about 30% are from the Dominican Republic. And then you have this other percentage from Japan and two countries that I, again, the firsthand experience with the Dominican and then hearing the stories about Japan. But just Latin American countries in general, they've had way less arm issues than people in the United States have. That is concerning to me. And I almost think that I don't think we throw enough.
Well, I would default to data that I don't have in front of me right now that I think may contradict some of what you're saying.
Okay, all I'm asking is go ahead to Jimbo down there in Birmingham, Alabama, my man James, and tell Dr. Andrews that I'd like to have a word with him. And I want to share my theory with him and hear why 90% of these cases have been Americans. And it would seem like if it's overuse, are we as Americans, are we not built to hold up? I think here's another kind of theory towards all of the arm injuries is we're now taught to throw at this maximum effort, and we've become so radar gun dependent. Whereas, James Andrews even said this. I remember reading this somewhere, but something along the lines of it's not the amount of pitches that you throw, it's how you throw the pitches, and it, meaning that these high leverage sort of situations, those will take a big time toll on you, as opposed to somebody like Greg Maddux that went out there and looked like he wasn't this max effort, so we're even just pinpointing.
Now you're onto something. So Glenn Fleissig, who's Dr. Andrews' partner down there, who's the chair on our board, talks about this. And down there, not only they're not just studying overuse injuries, they are studying mechanics and everything. And you're right about the radar gun. That is a problem in a lot of ways because that's what even my kids, like 8 years old, are like, Dad, I want a radar gun. Once they see, you know what I mean? They go to the little fair or whatever, and they throw the ball as hard as they can. And, my five-year-old's like, hey, I threw it 30 miles an hour. I mean, it's addicting. It's a fun little, you know, measure of how hard you throw. And then, you know, I think that's part of but that culture is also part of the reason why we're seeing such amazing arms in the big leagues right now is because these kids do get obsessed with it. And just like any other muscle in your body, the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And, you know, these kids have access to the radar gun younger and are throwing it harder and harder and harder. I mean, I love the arms in the major leagues right now. I would be hard pressed to say there was ever a time that there's been better or deeper good arms.
Totally agree. So you and I, we mentioned that we grew up together. We played on the same little league team, played the same high school team, played on the same summer ball team. We both played in the Pac-12. We both got into professional baseball around the same time. We trained together every single off season. Do you hear the chickens?
I do hear the chickens.
You realize we have 10 of them now.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a few.
10 of them. I couldn't believe, by the way, that I ended up getting chickens. And now there's two of them out there, Reba and Loretta. I've fallen in love with them. Every morning I get up, I go let them out of their little chicken coop. And they these are they're Americanos, right? And then we have 8 white silkies. Now, we had 3 other ones, but Mr. Hitch, one of my bulldogs. I got 4 bulldogs. this guy's a slayer. I mean, he had no mercy. Took down all 3. Like, and we had him in the coop. I mean, we're talking, he's almost 10 years old, and he went flying right through that thing. Well, just about one bite. He doesn't leave a whole lot left, too. Anyway, where I was going with all this was that we played through a time and especially when we first came up, that performance-enhancing drugs were prevalent around Major League Baseball. And I don't know if you experienced it. Now, we spent all this time together. You've heard the theory, show me who your friends are, and I'll show you who you are. And I don't ever remember personally getting offered a chance to do steroids. Like, I never had that, hey, like, you want to do this? You want... Now, I obviously had my suspicions of who was doing it and who wasn't, but at the same time, I never sought it out. And then ultimately, you know, I know we discussed it several times, but you know, you made the decision not to use performance enhancing drugs for whatever reasons. And I had my own personal reasons as well, but I think a lot of it was we confided in each other, and it's, hey, look, if we're not good enough to make it on our own without this artificial substance, which, you know, many would consider cheating, then screw it. Then, you know, I think also, though, when you look at yourself and myself as well, I think we had visions past baseball, and that was probably another reason where I don't think this was the end-all be-all, and I think there's a lot of people that, you know, they made the different decision to do it knowing that, hey, look, this is it. This is my life. This is my one shot, my one opportunity. If I don't make this here, if this does not happen now, my life's over. And I got to say, you and I are, I think in a lot of ways, fortunate. We never went down that road. But when I look at your career, I think that of all the people that were affected by steroid users, by performance-enhancing drug users, it was somebody like you, somebody who had great skills, a great hand, as good a hand-eye coordination as I've ever seen, the ability to pick the barrel of the bat and put it on the baseball, good power, hit 20 home runs, a few seasons in the minor leagues, no problem. But you weren't super fast, right? And it wasn't necessarily the light tower power that would have happened had you decided to indulge in performance enhancing drugs. Where are you on this?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty big issue, because now that I look back at my career, yeah, I didn't take them. I didn't want to disappoint my mother. I also wasn't desperate. Like you said, I always felt like I was going to have a comfortable, successful life after the game, which the majority of players, this is their way out. So anything that they can possibly do, they would do. You know, so there was a lot of people that did fall in the category I was in who decided not to do them, you know, and even though I look back and I still did get to play in the major leagues, but never really got what I would describe as a fair shake opportunity of a year or two of at bats to let myself, you know, grow and learn the major leagues. And the one thing that really happened when I look back at it, now that I watch the big leagues, is we had guys out there, and you could go through rosters that were chock full of 35, 36, 37-year-old players. And it really elongated careers out there for position players, particularly that doesn't usually happen at all anymore when you look at these rosters as far as how old they are. And what that did is it really did take a generation of players that were coming up and got them, you know, less opportunities to really, you know, become great ball players. And I know there was guys in the big leagues at the time that didn't use steroids that did really well, you know. But yeah, if I had 20 home runs, Eric, right now in the minor leagues, 3 years in a row, batting around 300, I'd be a top prospect in almost every organization if you look at the numbers out there as far as what minor leaguers do to become prospects in these days. But unlike you, I remember being offered steroids in A-ball in the Midwest League. And in the clubhouse, guys talking about it, and then going back, and then
who offered you steroid? Other players?
Other players? Yeah, there was two guys. When I walked into our apartment, you know, you've got a $900 apartment being shared by five guys, you know, for $200 a month or whatever, and you know, one of the guys sitting there just had the other guy injecting him, and I was just blown away because there was nothing at Stanford, there was nothing like that. I mean, Stanford was not. In fact, there may have been other schools in college I'm sure it was prevalent at, but there was nothing I even knew of at Stanford. So this was eye-opening to me, and I'm like, whoa, you know, where am I? And that was my first season. And then as the years go by and, you know, being in the minor leagues, it didn't get offered to me, but it was around. You know, and I'm sure you could say the same thing. If you really wanted it, you knew it was there. But I really think the reason it wasn't offered was because it was the, you know, you're competing with guys in that clubhouse, and they don't want to give it to you. People are like, oh, was it offered you? No. Why would somebody want to give it to me if they think it's their edge? So I don't think it was offered. Now, I think it was a little bit of the Wild West and A-ball, and that stuff gets weeded out, and those kids, I don't even think barely any of them ever made it to, you know, double A, triple A, or beyond. But it was going on quite a bit, and I always knew it was going on. It wasn't, you know.
That's a great point when it comes to other guys in the clubhouse. And why would they offer it? Why would they want you to have the same advantage that they have? I likened it a lot to the cocaine culture. And not that I know a ton about the cocaine culture, but from going out back in the day, and you know, you and I both have some mutual friends that got into the booger sugar. And I could think of nights that we were all out together and we'd be out in the city and we'd go to Mos Saki and we'd have a few drinks and some sake bombs and we've got a nice little buzz going and we might head up to Balboa Cafe or City Tavern, right? And a couple more drinks, we'll take a shot of tequila, like we're great. And then, you know, let's hit up the club and, you know, we're at the club, we're like, hey man, this is cool, I've got great buzz. And then we have, I don't know, let's say one or two of our boys or maybe more that they're kind of in their own element. And you're like, man, like, dude, they got, wow, what a buzz. As our buzz is starting to wear off towards the end of the night, they're not selling any more drinks. And you and I are like, man, are you ready to shut it down? Yeah, let's go. Let's head back to the hotel or go back home or whatever, depending on whether or not we got a place up in the city that night. And then these dudes, like, man, their eyes are popping out of their head and – the whole time they would try to keep it from us. And I know, you know, even to this day, it still happens when I'll hang around these guys, they'll try, because they know that's not a road that I'm going to go down. They don't want me knowing what they're doing, yet it becomes pretty apparent and pretty obvious. It wasn't until I was in my mid thirties and we ran it pretty hard back, say from, you know, the time we got out of college to, say, let's call it the mid-30s or something. But I had never seen cocaine. I'd never seen it. And it was the same thing with steroids. Still is. I don't even know if I've seen steroids. I remember seeing syringes and needles that were associated to steroids with somebody you and I both know. But I don't think I saw the actual whatever steroids are or whatever they look like. I've never seen it. And it wasn't until I was about 35 that I saw the white powder for the first time. So really both of these cultures, I think, do a pretty decent job of hiding it.
Yeah, there's a subculture for sure within baseball and guys that knew each other. Once somebody on the team, you know, was doing steroids and they'd find someone else was doing steroids and there was – they may bond over that. I felt like I was watching that go on, but you're right. I didn't hear what their conversations, but suddenly they'd be hanging out. You know, you kind of see these little cliques of guys that made sense. And yeah, you're right. Cocaine, serious, same thing, you know. And that's on the same vein of that with cocaine. It's like, dude, we go out, give me another Red Bull vodka. This is gonna, you know, that's gonna get me going. That's gonna keep me up that extra hour. Right? I mean, that's that. Well, on the steroid performance enhancing thing, hey, don't get me wrong. We were taking our protein shakes and our energy stuff to get, you know what I mean, to get our edge while we were working out. It wasn't like we weren't doing anything.
We were taking everything.
But, you know,
we were doing absolutely everything we could without injecting
within the law. Exactly.
Within the law. It was, I mean, just like you said, I mean, it was every supplement that you could dream of. And then you had to, by the end, and once the drug testing was enforced, I think it was 2003 2002 was the first year of random testing, and then 2003, I think, was the first year of testing. And then if a certain amount had tested over that, and then it was 04, 05 is really when it came into law. But it was – we had to do it. And I'll go back, and I say this all the time. I'll go back and I'll look at pictures of myself early on. And then now, obviously, getting into the triathlons and the ultramarathons, it's a completely different build of body that I have. If I was a random person and I click on the internet and I see an old picture of me then, and then I turn on MLB Network and I see a picture of me now, I'd be like, oh, this guy juiced for sure.
Yeah, no, and we worked out, and I know you didn't. And that's a culture that, I mean, we had our own little culture, mm-hmm. which was, you know, doing things the right way as far as I'm concerned. And even baseball, if you just back up on baseball for a second. And there's an obsession with this strength. And the guy I remember in college when I went down to visit you at UCLA, Troy Glaus, who you guys had just started a weight program. We didn't have a weight program at Stanford yet at all. Like, not even a weight program, period. And UCLA had just started this weight program, and Troy went
in. This is like mid to late 90s.
This is mid to late 90s, exactly.
This isn't that long ago.
There was already steroids in the big leagues, but the college wasn't there yet at all. And so, and I think – you know, you guys were doing your test of 135, and I remember Troy saying, yeah, I couldn't even get it up once.
He can't.
And on a bench press. Yet, you put him on the field as a freshman, and he's hitting with, like you're saying, moonshots out there. And there is a leverage and quickness of hands and everything that is innate to a ball player that I still go back to, all right, steroids obviously worked and did something. You know, how many guys were hitting 60 home runs a year and all that? I mean, there is great data. You want to get into data? There's great data that steroids worked. However, there is still this talent that you had to have. Mm-hmm. And that's why when you get back to me and why I can be as bitter as anybody ever in this game is I had that talent that didn't get a chance to produce in the big leagues because of that culture going on around me, because there was – how many guys were hitting 30, 40 home runs? It was insane, right? I mean, mm-hmm. and who knows? I mean, there was guys that hit 50 home runs and then hit 9 the next year. I mean, when they weren't on the juice anymore. So I don't know how that all affected it and steroids worked.
Yeah, your talent got suppressed too. You should have been a second baseman. you had the quickest feet and the quickest hands I'd ever seen, and it was amazing. Who screwed up along the way in either at Stanford or in professional baseball that didn't notice it and didn't give you an opportunity to play second base? Because now what happened is you weren't the fastest guy, so they would see that and they're like, oh, hey, you went to Stanford, and they threw you over at first base, right? And you played first and third, but really I think your biggest strength would have been turning a double play at second, getting that feed from the shortstop, firing it over, and then your feet were so quick. And I mean, it was – we would do these drills, the ladder drills, with T, the guy that we worked out with, and we'd do the shuffle through the thing, and he'd time us. And you and I could go out, we could run 100, and I would smoke you. I would leave you in the dust in the first, I don't know, no, 10 yards. But the quickness of your feet – was so incredible that every time on those ladder drills and every time we timed it you would completely blow me out of the water.
Yeah, and everybody's does have their skill sets, and this comes to just coaching growing up. I mean, I remember you got your scholarship, I think, to UCLA, and Gary Adams is a great coach, and I'm not sure who was behind the decision that said Eric Burns should be a catcher. And senior year of high school, they put you behind the plate. This was an experiment.
That's Chris, Chris Bradford.
Gone haywire. It was one of the worst. It was. I mean, I remember being on the team.
We love CB, and we didn't have a catcher. Let's remember this, though. Let's remember this. That year, we started out 20-0, and we were ranked number one by USA Today in the country.
Totally agree. And we had a ton of talent on our team. But your talent – and your best skill is it was speed, which in the outfield is the most obvious spot for you, where you did end up, you know, finding your way there.
I know. Not only that, get this.
But catching was the worst. I mean, I look back. That is one of the worst ideas I can come up with somebody to do it. That you have
it.
Speed and all of this. I mean,
I love it.
I mean, it was like Biggio came up a catcher, and they got him out of there right away because
You know what? I'll forever be grateful to Chris Bradford, who was our legendary high school baseball coach at St. Francis, who is still coaches today, or still is very involved in the program today. In my opinion, should still be coaching, but apparently he says he invested too much of his life into it and took every loss home with them and, you know, hung on every – anyway, the bottom line, I'll be forever grateful for him for giving me that opportunity because I think after I caught, it gave me an entire new perspective on the game of baseball. It was one of the most challenging and ridiculously difficult things I'd ever done in my life. Athletically, it wasn't even close, but it gave me an appreciation for the game. Now, all that said, when I was drafted out of high school, I got drafted in the 38th round by the Los Angeles Dodgers. If you go back and look at the 1994 draft and you go to the 38th round, it says Eric Burns, Portola Valley, California, St. Francis High School, center field. So that actually gave me – it was funny. I laughed at it because I had never played center field in my life going into college even. As a matter of fact, this gets better. The first time I ever played center field in a game was in the big leagues. Not big league spring training, in the big leagues. And it was when Jermaine Dye got hurt. I had an opportunity to play in 2003 on a daily basis after that. I got hot, went on a nice little hitting streak. And when Jermaine Dye came back, I had played myself in the lineup, so to speak. And Chris Singleton, at the time, I'm not sure if he was scuffling or what the deal was, but when Jermaine Dye came back and he played – right field, which is where I was playing, they moved me to center. And I just started playing center field. And I, you know, even now, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on this because you coach your kids' little league team. But I would say this is very important in professional baseball. And we realize how increasingly important it is the versatility of players. So the A's, as a matter of fact, were actually one of the pioneers of doing this. But after I was in the big leagues, I remember going back to, say, you know, minor league camp, or you see it in minor league camp, and we would do this in the big leagues too, where we would rotate. So every inning that you would play during scrimmages and inter squads, or even in a game that wasn't a real big league spring training game, you would come in, you would play left field one inning, you play center field the next inning, you played right field the next, and you keep rotating through. Third base would go play shortstop would go play second would go play first. And their whole concept was, look, we need to find a way, however we can, to try to get as much offense in here as possible. But it also gives these other guys opportunities to become good defensive players at other positions.
I mean, that's such a big deal. I mean, just to learn the game, right? I mean, now, assuming that when you're dealing with kids, that they have the talent to make the throw from certain positions, you don't want to put somebody in a position where they can't actually play the position properly. That's no fun for any kid to do. But as you get older, moving around the infield, I remember going to first base. The first time I played first base was in college, and moving over there, and I had played second and short mostly, and some third, and you get over there, and I really didn't even know where to play, how to hold, where my feet were to hold the runner on. There's a lot when dealing with cuts at first base, dealing with the pitcher, pickoffs, bunt plays, and stuff that it was completely different than third base. In fact, it's more complicated, but you learn the strategy of the game. I mean, it's you need to do it. I did the same thing when I learned outfield, where we rotated around, and by the way, the fact you moved to center field in the big leagues, that is the easiest position in the outfield, those two corner spots. If you start in the corner spots, which is extremely just balls hooking, slicing, center field to me, you're covering more ground. But if you were to be stuck in a first-time position, you're more likely to be or less likely to be exposed in center field than you would be in the corner spot.
I totally disagree, and I'll tell you why. Because center field, although the reads are easier in center field, and I don't think there's any question about that, it's a lot easier to read the ball off the bat. The demand of the position and the area to cover and the fact that you're the quarterback in the outfield make it that much more difficult. Now, could you stick anybody out there for a few games? Sure. Could you get by with it? Most likely. But eventually, and you know this, you'll get exposed. If you play enough games out there, whether it's center, left, or right, and you've never played the outfield, you saw it with Kyle Schwarber last year, and really he did a great job. He just got exposed in the playoffs. That's when, unfortunately for the Cubs, all this happened. But it's the vital importance of playing different positions is huge in the world that the baseball world that we live in today.
Well, it's the opportunity you get. I mean, so I was fortunate to play without anybody basically telling me I can't play for, you know, until I was in my 30s, right? Well, at some point, everybody's career, you know, is over, and they can't play baseball anymore at sort of the highest level. The way to make it last longer is to know more positions, period.
Mm-hmm. Hanley Ramirez is – they tried him in left field last year. It was an absolute disaster. And now – they're moving him to first base. This was a shortstop at one time, a premier shortstop. When people ask me how Hanley would do in the outfield, making the transition from shortstop to left field, and left field at Fenway Park, which I believe is the easiest left field in all of baseball to play, just because, sure, you have to learn how to play the wall. It's not that hard. Once you learn how to play the wall, you have no ground to cover. You get to play shallow. You take away line drives. Anything hit over your head, for the most part, is going to hit the wall. It is the easiest left field in all of baseball to play. Yet he completely freaking butchered it. I thought to myself, how could a guy who's that great of an athlete be such a debacle out there in left field last year? And for Hanley, it's got to be because he wasn't into it.
He's not putting the work in,
yeah,
period.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not going to sit here and make any excuse other than he's not willing to put the work in and he doesn't want it bad enough. Because we've seen the talent he has year after year. He just doesn't want it bad enough. You go out there and Fenway, I mean, you go out there batting practice and you can learn that wall, no problem. And you just need to apply yourself. Every other pitch, you get ready, you go for it, or every pitch, whatever it is. And I saw, yeah, we saw some plays last year that, I mean, there's no excuse for him.
So first base. Now, the argument was from a lot of first basemen. Sean Casey told me, look, first base ain't easy. Like, if you think you could stick anybody over at first base, as a matter of fact, of all the positions on the field, in my entire baseball career, spanning back to you and I in Alpine Little League and Peninsula Building Materials, a.k.a. Maury's, and the Dynasty team that we played on there, the only position I never played was first base.
Well, if you're asking me, is he going to survive at first base? I think he can survive at first base, particularly because Hanley spent so much time in the infield.
Yeah.
So for him, because he has been at third base, shortstop, he's going to be okay. He understands some of the basic stuff. The one thing that happens at first base, though, you really, and particularly the way the small ball's taken over the big leagues this year or the last couple years, is that bunt, he could be exposed on. Because when he's been in the outfield, I'm not sold that he's ready every pitch and that he's into it. And anybody that I'm sure you play with some great bunters over the years, those guys that are good, they pay attention to that. They know, and they're looking the corner guys. And if there's a corner guy that's sleeping, they'll go right at him. And so I think that's something to look out for probably early in the year as far as guys bunting and dragging and bringing it with them to first. But and then learning how to play with the second baseman can be a challenge too.
What do you have on the sabermetrics revolution and the direction the game seems to be heading with numbers and English we're speaking here on this podcast. Where do you think the game's going? How much do you like it? And really, is there a happy median between the place where we had the old school scout, you know, say, hey, look, the ball sounds different coming off his bat, or just watching the guy out there as opposed to just looking at a piece of paper. And what seemingly a lot of these front offices are doing now, or they're playing the game on a spreadsheet.
No. So there's two different sabermetrics. This is the way I see it. You've got sabermetrics in scouting, and then you've got sabermetrics in the major leagues, right? But to me, that's different. Scouting, those old school scouts are still as important as anything. Who's going to improve character? Who's going to survive? Who's going to get out of trouble? Who's coachable? All of that stuff. Those are intangibles that scouts, that's what they get paid for. You know, who knew that Arrieta was going to be, have that year last year when I was with them on that Olympic team versus Cahill, you know, the scouting, you know, scouting figures that out. Now you've got sabermetrics in the big leagues, right? Now, sabermetrics in the big leagues, I don't believe they're using it that much, because based upon what I've at least read, is that every team should bat their best player at leadoff.
First.
And nobody does that.
Buck Showalter's going to.
So if that actually starts to take over the game, now you've got sabermetrics at the big leagues that has gone overboard. But for me right now, and I don't even know if that is overboard, because no one's done it before.
Buck Showalter's doing it.
And so Showalter's going to do it. And if he wants to, experiment with it, I love it.
I love it too.
I mean, for me.
Of course, it's a little league theory. Put your best player, have him get the most at bats. Over the course of the season, what is it? Anywhere between 50 and 100 plate appearances more?
Yeah. How many home runs would a Bonds hit that year? 73. Would have hit 80 if he batted leadoff? What are you going to say? That was a bad – I mean, was that a bad decision if he hit 80 instead of 73? No. So for me, the sabermetrics in the big leagues, I still think they are very slow on the uptick.
Well, I think one of the reasons why, too, if you look at the anti-sabermetric teams and the success that they've had between – the Giants, they have always been known to be slower moving on it. The same is true with the Kansas City Royals. Boston was at the forefront, but John Farrell's got a little old school in him. Ned Yost, the Royals manager, obviously he has a bunch of old school in him. I think Bruce Bochy's just this brilliant blend of just figuring out what buttons to push at what time. And then, you know, of course, Mike Matheny and the solid success that the Cardinals have had. Everything that I've heard come out of his mouth seems to be they got the right blend going on in St. Louis. And then Joe Maddon with the Cubs and the success that he had in Tampa, he seems to be pretty much at the forefront of the revolution. So you have, you know, these old school managers that you put in one corner and gut instinct sort of guys, and then you have, you know, the new school. But then again, who would have thought that we were going to put Buck Showalter at the top of the list of the new school guys? And I think that's a testament to him and his ability to embrace the direction that he feels the game's going, that a lot of people feel the game is going.
But it's not – there's no steadfast rule to this. This is what I'm getting at. This is what I like about it. It's opening up new options and new thinking. But at the same time, you can't – put a probability on the human mind and how it's going to react in certain situations. So Showalter may put his best hitter number one, but that particular best hitter doesn't do well in the first inning of every game for whatever reason. He's always been better at the, you know, there's stats to back that up.
Sure.
So that he might not have his guy there. And there may, you know, and so we're going to figure this out as they start to get into sabermetrics more.
My biggest theory when it comes to, let's just say splits, your standard, you know, lefty versus lefty or righty versus righty, and then go ahead and the opposite. So you're always trying to match up, right? And the Oakland A's have been doing this for years. There's got to be numbers to support the fact that I saw Omedo Science, and this is at, I believe it was the last year of the old ballpark, Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati. And Omedo Science, I saw him hit a ball into the new ballpark in Cincinnati, which was being built across the street in his first at-bat. In his second at-bat, he hit a screaming double off the top of the wall. In his third at-bat, now Omedo Science was a right-handed hitter. In his third at-bat, a right-handed pitcher was put into the game. Omedo Science was pinch hit for. So you're telling me that a guy who is a left-handed hitter who's cold, sitting on the bench, has not been put in the game, for all we know, is mowing hot dogs and cheeseburgers and fries just, I don't know, what, 45 minutes before that, and now all of a sudden's got a little gas, digestive issues, not in – grab a bat, grab a helmet, and you and we think you have a better shot of getting a hit off this right-hander than the guy who's just absolutely dialed in and is 2-for-2 with a bomb and a double in his first two at-bats? No freaking way. Even if the numbers tell me that player X, who was crushing the cheeseburgers and the hot dogs and the french fries 45 minutes beforehand, is a 300 hitter against right-handed pitching, as opposed to Omedo Saenz is a 250 hitter against right-handed pitching. Well, guess what? Omedo Saenz, and you know this as well as I do, just from squaring up a couple balls, your confidence level is through the roof when you go up there for that next at-bat. So there is no way you can tell me that lefty has a better chance of getting the hit against that righty than Omedo Saenz did against that righty at that time.
It's tough to argue with you, although I did pinch hit for Larry Walker for my first home run when they brought in a lefty against him, and I think he had a hit that day also, and it was probably his third at-bat. And I had a lot of success against lefties.
You pinch hit for Larry Walker?
Yeah, for Larry Walker.
Walker's a Hall of Famer in my mind. Oh, now, he hasn't been inducted, but Larry Walker's a Hall of Famer.
One of the greatest teammates. Of the greatest teammates, too. He's absolutely first rate. There's nothing but good things you can say about Larry
Walker.
He's
a Canuck, right?
Oh, big time. Yeah, big time Canadian, yeah. Yeah, wears it proud. But getting back to your theory on pinch hitting, that's completely true. I mean, when you feel good at the plate, and especially when you're talking about the way that Saenz is feeling good at the plate, oh my God, you're not getting a couple of, you know, seeing eye hits or a couple of squared up singles. I'm talking about balls that you're crushing. Don't take him out of the game. I know. I mean, but you know, Eric, there's different ways to skin this cat, and that's why baseball is such a great game. Is you can sit around and you can talk about it. There's different ways that these teams have won over the years. I mean, the Royals weren't the Giants. I can tell you that.
We already talked about steroids. Let's lighten it up a little bit. Let's get into gambling. DraftKings, FanDuel, Daily Fantasy Sports is all the buzz right now. And Major League Baseball, as a matter of fact, you could tell, just watch MLB Network. We were promoting DraftKings every single day, FanDuel. I believe they had a partnership with the NFL. They were all over that. As a matter of fact, I believe even Major League Baseball is actually invested. I know the Kraft Group is up in New England. They're invested, and this is a Boston company, DraftKings, but they're invested into the company. Major League Baseball, I still believe, is invested into the company. The New York Attorney General came out, and he banned it, and he said it's illegal. This is gambling. It's now going through the courts right now. Major League Baseball has undoubtedly they've taken a back seat, and they said, okay, we'll back off. The investment is what it is, whatever we put in there. But I think they're getting away from advertising. I got an email today talking about, us not being able to play daily fantasy. Just if you work for the network, you can't play daily fantasy. Where's all this sitting with you?
This is a tough one for me. I mean, obviously, people watch sports and people gamble on sports, and they are intertwined, whether or not the Attorney General wants to admit it or Major League Baseball wants to admit it or NFL or whoever. So, you know, fantasy sports, I mean, that runs, and if you want to throw DraftKings as fantasy sports, but I mean, that runs the NFL. I'm not even sure if I'd watch the NFL, especially with the way the Niners are, because I grew up a fan of them, and it's terrible to watch them. But with fantasy, every Sunday, I'm involved. And now that you've got you've got DraftKings, it's like you have fantasy at your fingertips basically 365 days a year. And so to try to separate out DraftKings, mostly because they're making all this money, and there's questions about how fair it's been. So I look at it, and I have no problem with I just assume all gambling be legal to, you know, as long as it's regulated properly. And I think this is no different. DraftKings just needs to be regulated properly. And I think that's been some of the questions that have been going on, you know, and the stuff I've read about, you know, said, hey, who's actually you know, getting the information behind, you know, there was a, some of those employees making a bunch of money, you know, with information, proprietary information. That needs to be regulated. Right now, there's no regulation and there's no laws going on. So, I mean, do I feel comfortable with the way it is right now? It's fine, but it needs to change, and I think it's going to.
Yeah, I mean, if, first of all, the whole gambling thing is, I think it's a joke. The fact that we can't get legalized sports gambling in all 50 states, it's embarrassing. And I say that because people are going to decide to spend their money however they want to spend their money. And there's actual people, and this is DraftKings and FanDuel's claim, the daily fantasy sports claim, is that there's a skill that goes to it. Well, guess what? There's a skill that goes into sports gambling too. All you're doing, if you're playing DraftKings or FanDuel, you're individualizing it. But when you can go ahead and individualize a whole team and you put data into a computer that spits out numbers and information, I heard something. I don't have the numbers here in front of me or any hard data to prove this. But I believe that the claim was from DraftKings or FanDuel that there's a very small percentage, very tiny percentage, be it 1% or 5% of the people win all the money. And that's it. That right there shows you that it's a skill. What's any different than playing that, than playing the stock market? I don't get it. I mean, that is, look, it is a risk every time I put a dollar into the freaking S&P 500. Every single time. The NASDAQ, it doesn't matter. Every time I'm gambling when I do that. And it's regulated. And rightfully so. And I'm not saying this shouldn't be regulated. It should be regulated. But it should be legalized. We're smoking weed in all these increasingly number of states every single year where alcohol is out there. Yet this is a thing that we still have as illegal when we have all sorts of issues in so many states, and we have this incredible federal deficit, yet we could be bringing in millions and millions, billions of dollars every single year if you monitor it and manage this correctly. It is a shame. It is a shame that sports gambling and daily fantasy is not legal in all 50 states.
Well, I'm going to take the opposite side just because it is an important opposite side. And gambling, it's not a healthy habit, okay? And there are...
Either is throwing your money away in the stock market.
Okay. Now, let's get
either
off...
Either is shopping at Neiman Markets.
Let's get off of buying
neither
the shares of a company.
Multiple bikes that are sitting behind your baseball glove chair right now.
But you can afford them. That's different. My point is gambling... I mean, there is a problem. It's an addiction. There's issues out there, and regulating it.
So
the way
is shopping.
Shopping is an addiction. I know, particularly for your wife, and you know, maybe even
so
your mother.
So are penny stocks.
Penny stock. Get off the stock market. Stock market. You're buying the share of a company, and you're sharing in their
Save
profits
it.
Or losses.
Save it. Yeah, that exactly. is a totally. And they have losses.
There's a total.
It's the same way gamblers do.
Well, we will agree to disagree on that, but. Gambling is a slippery slope at some level. I mean, if we were to start this thing all over, I mean, yeah, now you got pot getting legalized. I mean, why are cigarettes legalized? I mean, you could go down, and this is a rabbit hole, Eric. Like, I mean, there's more health issues with tobacco and cigarettes and you know, no benefits. I guess what I'm looking at from taking the opposite side is what's the benefits for gambling, unless you want to run into tax dollars that could be collected possibly.
For the individual entertainment.
Well, then what's...
Just like going to a movie, just like going to a show, just like going to the zoo, just like going to the park, just like going... It doesn't matter. You're paying for the entertainment because you know as well as I know, if we go ahead and we throw a couple bucks on a game and we fire it up on the TV, that right there is my entertainment for the next 3 hours.
And you just drilled my argument. There's not a problem to fix, Eric, because you just figured out a way to put money on the game. Have you ever had a problem putting money on a game if you wanted to gamble or an average person? My point is...
But that's a problem.
You're fixing a problem that doesn't exist.
Okay, but it does exist because all of what you're referring to is say, it's some sort of underground book or something, right? Now, all of a sudden, all that's doing is promoting promoting, like, these bookies have been there, they'll always be there. I get that. I know that. And ideally, if you legalize it and monitor, it's the same thing with the weed. The same exact thing. It's like, you know, all of a sudden, you have these legit operations. How much better and safer and not only that, profitable, how much more profitable does it become for the government if they're able to legalize it and monitor it? I think that's the next – I think it's going to happen. David Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, came out and said, hey, we want to legalize gambling. He knows how great it – he knows how great fantasy is for the NBA.
Well, I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time. I mean, and particularly being that it already exists, obviously, in Nevada, and it exists pretty much in every other state or every other Irish pub I've been to across the country. Mm-hmm. You can get a bet in at any moment of the night. So is it going to happen? Yes. I'm not concerned about, like, it's just when. That's all.
Speaking of that, one of the most fantastic things I think I'd ever seen in my life. I was in Baltimore, and I believe I was back there, moving out of my place after I got released from the Orioles. And we go into this crab shack, right? And it just kind of randomly go into this crab shack. And we're sitting there, supposedly, like, hey, great food. Yeah. With a couple of my buddies, and Monday Night Football game was about to start. And I was back there with a bullet assassin. And all of a sudden, some guy stands up in the middle of the restaurant and says, all right, it is going to be the Packers -6.5. The total is set at 42. I'll be taking action over here in the corner. And next, you know, a line of people go over to the corner. They're just placing their bets. Boom, boom, boom. I couldn't believe it.
That's old school. I like that.
Hey, so we're gonna do this. We're gonna do this a lot. I don't know how often you're into it, how often you're into wanting to do it, but we gotta come up with a name for your segment. I mean, the Gall Star. It's you want to spend the next week thinking about what exactly we'll call your time behind that mic.
Yeah, I think we need to come up with something, but you know, I don't have any good ideas at the moment. And I don't trust your first idea, so let's come back with something next week.
Hey, now I'm a Gall Star. Get your game on. At Burns22 on Twitter, if you want to come up with the Gall segment. Segment. Oh, this is beyond segment. We're an hour and 12 minutes into this thing.
Wow.
It's solid.
Time flew by.
It's solid. How do you like the podcast, long-form conversation?
Yeah, my first time doing it. I do like it, actually. It's very comfortable in these huge mitts I'm sitting in.
Now all of a sudden it's comfortable.
Yeah. It took an hour. It's all right.
You're sinking in now, though.
It needed to be broken in, I think.
All right, dude. Appreciate your time. And do you have any ideas? Come on. Give me one name for your power hour.
The Gall Star Power Hour.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
I like that.
Yeah, we'll go with that for now.
Real quick, because I want to take this to 1 hour and 14 minutes on the dot. Give me the guy that had the most pop that you ever played with. Most power.
Ever played? Mike Hessman.
Really? The guy that broke the minor league home run record last year?
Minor league. Although, actually, Rob Stratton. We used to watch his batting practice in the AAA. He was legendary. And you ask other guys that saw Rob Stratton. I didn't play with him, but Rob Stratton could hit the ball. He'd hit the ball 500-plus in batting practice all day, every day.
All right. We're at 114.
There you go.
Hey, now. He's a Gall Star.